Welcome to 20 Minute Tabletop, a podcast about board games, card games, and other forms of gaming. Basically, if you can get it on your tabletop and it isn't your dinner, then we're probably going to be talking about it at some point. Tonight we've got a first for 20 Minute Tabletop, and that first is a guest appearing on the show, a guest that I'm very excited to meet, and that's because between May 2020 and April 2022, this particular guest worked on an exceptionally successful podcast called Always Player One. And just to be clear, Always Player One was a podcast dedicated to solo board gaming. It was hosted by Norm and Scruffy and took a unique approach by focusing on what makes solo board games interesting rather than simply trying to provide reviews. And unlike typical review-based podcasts, Always Player One encouraged conversations with the listeners, which is evidenced even today by a very active Discord server. And the hosts almost wanted each episode to be the start or continuation of a dialogue with their audience. So I'm really pleased to have Norm on today in order to teach me a little bit more about a field of gaming that I have literally only dipped the toes into on a couple of occasions. I know that Kev does loads more of this than I do. And that field is solo board gaming. I've got quite a few questions to ask him, and I expect that by the end of the episode, I may be more inclined to give it another go. And I'm hoping that Norm can convince me today about why this should be something that I could give another go to. So, with the pomp and ceremonies of introductions out the way, I would like to introduce Andy Norman.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on, Tom.
Oh, well, it's a real pleasure. It's really nice to talk to you for the first time in person. And thanks for your support of the podcast since day one. It's been really appreciated.
Honestly, it's been fun. You've got a good thing going here. It's nice to be a fan from day one. You and Kev have got a real nice rapport, which is it's good. It's fun to listen to.
Oh, that's really good. It's really kind of you. So I suppose we'll start at the beginning. A good place to start. What got you into solo board gaming?
Yeah, I don't think it's an uncommon origin story. Mine is like many who come before me. My appetite and desire to play games just is greater than my opportunity to play games multiplayer. And I think that's really where it began. And I think even people who don't routinely play solo can empathize with that feeling, probably.
Oh, that's quite interesting. So it was literally the desire to play board games outweighing the opportunities to play board games. Would you go as far as to say that you'd rather be playing games with people, given the option?
Most of the time. Most of the time. I mean, this is it. So that was very much the start of the journey, right? So the start of the journey was you want to be playing games and you don't have the opportunity.
Yeah.
But then the more you play solo games, the more you realize that there's quite a rich tapestry of games to explore. And there's a lot of unexplored to you or to me at the time, benefits for solo gaming that I'm sure we'll unpack as a podcast and this episode goes ahead. But yeah, would I prefer to be playing with more people? Yeah, I mean, generally, the magic of gaming, I'm sure everyone will agree there is a social element. But, you know, if you remove that element, is gaming still fun? For me, absolutely. And yeah, I'm hoping that this is what I get to share with you throughout this episode.
Yeah, well, that'd be really good. And obviously, the last two episodes that we've put out on 20 Minute Tabletop have all been about the etymology of, you know, starting to really love and enjoy gaming. Was it a childhood thing for you that kind of carried on into adulthood? Or did you have a resurgence later on in life?
It's interesting you ask that question, because I came to board games quite late on. I was sort of in my mid-20s. And it's interesting you ask that question because your first episode was about Thirsty Meeples.
Yeah.
And I got into board games in general because I used to live in Oxford and I took a punt at spending an evening in a board game cafe. And I walked in and saw their thousands of games in their library and thought, what on earth have I just walked into? I've only come here to play Monopoly.
Yeah, it's a bit like discovering Narnia, isn't it? Opening up your wardrobe and seeing this whole new world that you've never knew existed, I think, when you actually start looking into board gaming.
Yeah, but to get back to your original question, was it something from my childhood? Not really, is the answer. I was very much into video games. Video games were really, really important to me in my childhood and adolescence. And the more I fell out of love with video games or the things that I didn't like about what that industry was doing or what the community was like playing online,
yeah,
I found the complete opposite in the tabletop community.
Yeah, and from my limited knowledge, and I do have limited knowledge of the solo board gaming sphere, but it does feel to me like there's a bit of a renaissance going on at the minute. I mean, I bought Wingspan recently and I was really surprised to see that you could play Wingspan solo. I'm not sure if I'd ever want to do that really, but would you agree that there is a solo board gaming renaissance going on at the minute?
Yeah, 100%. Like, at the moment, especially coming out of the pandemic, there's this real appetite for wanting to play games when there's nobody else around. Many people, like myself, don't have the opportunity to play with their friends and family. My partner would never play a game with me. So if I didn't play solo during the pandemic, that would have been 2 years that my entire collection just went untouched. And do I think that's led to a renaissance? Absolutely. In fact, it's funny that you bring up Wingspan.
Yeah.
And you said you were surprised to see that because there are a number of publishers who are really, really clued into the fact that the solo gaming community is a growing community and something that they should be making games for and designing games for, or at least not leaving them out or excluding them from the fun. And Stonemaier have been sort of at the forefront of that a little bit, in that all of their games come with an Automa deck available. So go right the way back to, you know, Jamie Stegmaier's Viticulture, Scythe, you know, and you mentioned Wingspan. It's a part of their core purpose, is, as far as I understand, to make sure that one player mode is an option.
Would you say, though, you know that often you get a board game and the box says, you know, you can play it with two to this number, many players, but they really know that you need four or five to make a game sing. Would you say that the Stonemaier automata modes are actually viable? Do they work? Or is it just a thrown-in add-on to encourage more people to buy the game?
Oh, is it a cynical thing to chuck on the box just to increase sales? Is that what you're asking? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I must say, when I saw Wingspan and I played Wingspan, there wasn't a part of me that could imagine myself sitting and playing Wingspan as a one-player solo game, even if it did work. So I just wondered if it was, I suppose cynical is probably a little bit too harsh, but are these things put in literally just to say we can do this, even though it's not really as good, I suppose is what I'm saying.
I think there's an element in that in a lot of things in board gaming, not just player count, but, you know, there are a lot of board games that say they have a campaign mode and actually, does it need it?
Yeah, I totally hear you on that. I think I've got Escape Curse of the Temple, which has got a kind of thrown-in campaign mode, but I can't imagine anybody's ever sat
exactly
and played that all the way through.
Yeah, the moving away from Stonemaier and just speaking in general, I think, yeah, these things do work. I think what we're getting onto is something I was hoping we could discuss in the show, which is what are the credentials to make a game a good solo game?
What I'm really interested in is exactly that. What makes a great solo board game a great solo board game? And what I'm specifically interested in is, do you think there are any kind of field of mechanics that are more unique to solo board gaming? Is there something that I haven't experienced as a board gamer?
That is a very difficult question to answer.
Yeah.
I mean, the scope for play is almost as wide as it is with any player count. And there are as many advantages and opportunities for design in this player count as there are restrictions as well.
Yeah.
I think when it comes to what makes a good solo game, it's difficult to answer something that is such a sort of broad question. But I think what all these games need to have in common is what makes the game fun needs to be the interaction with the game and the mechanisms and your own puzzle and that sort of satisfaction from completing your own puzzle,
yeah,
rather than the interaction with the players. I'll give you an example, right? If you'll go with me on this one.
Yes, absolutely.
If we compare to games that are in a lot of ways very similar, but the core element of what makes them fun is slightly different, you'll see what perhaps goes into a game being satisfying solo versus not. So if we look at like Azul and Sagrada, these are both drafting games. They both came out in 2017. They're both placement games, puzzly little placement games, and they're both super hot and popular the year of their release.
And in fact, I would go as far as to say that I still play Azul. You know, it's one of my most regularly played games. It still holds it for me, actually.
And Azul doesn't have a solo mode out of the box. That's correct, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Sagrada does. And I think the core difference here is if you look at Azul, a lot of the fun around Azul becomes a dance around how am I going to interact with my opponent in a way that I'm going to leave them with exactly what they don't need to take all these minus points, right? It's this player interaction where you're dancing around, I don't want to be the one left with the rubbish, you know?
Yeah, 57 snowflakes that are going to have to come at the bottom of the board, yeah. I mean, it's balancing, isn't it, between whether you take what you want or you take what other people need at that particular time.
So if half of the satisfaction is completing that puzzle around sort of player uncertainty and what your opponents are going to do and leave for you, then it probably won't make a very satisfying solo experience.
Yeah.
If you compare to Sagrada, Sagrada is a game that, although it's very similar, it's drafting, you're placing stuff onto your player board and you're leaving things for your opponent. It's a game with a lot more sort of restrictions around what you can place. Each time you play, the scoring mechanisms are different. You know, you have different scoring cards. The fun and the compelling element of that game is, can I optimize my puzzle? Not how can I dance around this draft in a way that's going to be beneficial to me and negative for my opponent. Therefore, you're seeing the bones of what makes a good solo game. It's that core idea of this game is satisfying enough to just interact with the mechanisms and complete my own puzzle without having to worry about the players. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it absolutely makes sense. It's the puzzle nature of it that is going to bring you back. And would you say that you ever compete with yourself when you're playing a game like that? Do you keep a record of your previous scores and try to improve on that each game? Or does that not matter? Is it just at the moment, the actual puzzle of it at the time?
Well, Sagrada specifically has a very interesting mechanism where the dice that you leave, the dice that you don't choose, get placed on the round tracker. And at the end of the game, you add up all those dice and that becomes the score that you're competing against, which is very elegant. But the reason I bring this up is because sometimes you won't score particularly high, but it's a low scoring game because of the way the dice came out anyway. So it's fine. But yes, to answer your question, 100%. There are lots of games where I know what my high score is. I know exactly what my high score is. I know my high score in Mage Knight is 242. And I know every time I get it out of the box, the hope is to beat that score.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I want to talk to you about Mage Knight, actually. I noticed that your moniker online is Mage Norm. And I could see that you were a fan of that game. And it's a game I've never played, actually. I've heard lots of good things. In fact, I have heard if you have Mage Knight played by 3 people, then you have to be committed to spending 2.5 weeks to get through a game. So it may actually be better suited to solo board gaming. I mean, what you're saying actually does resonate with me. I've played Lord of the Rings Living Card Game solo once, two-handed. And for me, the puzzle was great. It was great, but there were also elements of that game, moments that happened that I just wished I had somebody around the table to say, look at that, how are we going to deal with this situation that's arisen? So I kind of missed the other players. But I get a game like Sagrada isn't necessarily going to have those big moments that you want to talk about and you can just enjoy the puzzle. I totally understand what you're saying. Would you talk to me about Mage Knight a little bit? Would you be happy to?
Would I be happy to talk about Mage Knight? I did it for about 30 episodes on my own show, so I don't see why not.
This is 20 minute tabletop. I can change the title to 20 hour tabletop if you like. We can go and tell you what, why don't we do this? If somebody wasn't familiar with Mage Knight, you know, how would you sell it to them as a game?
Ooh, how would I start them as a game? I would say Mage Knight is an adventure game, which has all of the tropes and trappings of a normal adventuring sort of quest-built role-playing light game, but with all the crunch and satisfaction of the very best Euro.
Right, okay.
It is incredibly difficult, insanely difficult, very rules-heavy, takes a long time to play, is probably better played solo or maybe two-player.
Yeah.
But is arguably one of the most satisfying, and in my opinion, probably the most satisfying solo experience you could
have. Yeah, it has been on my list, to be honest, to try for the last few years. It's quite old now, isn't it? Is it roughly 2011 when it came out?
Yeah, yeah. It's 2011. It's a bit of an oddball, to be honest with you. It's a bit of an odd duck in the hobby, in that it plays like a Euro in how you have to approach your turns, but it's also very random and completely unapologetic about its random elements.
Yeah.
It's by Vlada Shvartal, the chap who did Through the Ages and Codenames.
And Galaxy Trucker as well, actually, which was the first board game that was definitely in 2011 that got me back into the hobby. I remember watching a review of that and thinking, I'm in, let's have a go at that. So he's quite a diverse designer, isn't he?
Yeah, he's top lad. But yeah, Mage Knight is fantastic. But I'm not saying anything new here. Lots of people who are into solo games will enjoy Mage Knight.
You've just made me think I do need to try it at some point. And so, can I ask you, what kind of different ways do you go about playing solo? Do you leave a game on the table, or do you use Board Game Arena? Can you play solo on Board Game Arena? How do you go about it?
You can play solo on Board Game Arena. And in fact, the Atoma for Gaia project beat me up pretty bad this morning. How do you go about playing a solo game? Well, it depends on the design of the game, because there's so much you can look to do and so much scope for how you can approach a game like this. So first of all, there are obviously solitaire games that are built only for solitaire players. Thinking of, Freedom of Freeze's Friday,
yeah.
That is designed for one player only. There are multiplayer games with a solo mode. We've already alluded to a couple in Wingspan and Sagrada, Mage Knight. There are cooperative games. So cooperative games, if you think of like Pandemic, this is a game that you probably wouldn't think of if you were trying to make a list of solo games. But being entirely open information and cooperative, again, it has that element of the thing that's fun about that game is it's you versus the game and not you versus the players. So by removing the players, you're having the same core experience, just like you did with Lord of the Rings, the living card game in your example. But I mean, you can go as far as you want. I know some people, and it's a very popular thing to do if you look at sort of traditional war games. Like, when I say war games, I don't mean the little grey unpainted dudes that Kev talks about. I mean war games as in like historical board games. It's very common in the tradition of those games for people to play both sides.
Right, okay.
These games are so complicated, it's difficult to find people to play with, so just play both sides and do your best for each one. And that can be a satisfying experience. Sometimes it can be a little bit of a dull affair. It depends on the type of game and how the information's held and how well you can decompartmentalize each faction in your brain, you know?
Yeah, well, I suppose it's just taking you back to a childhood state to some degree, isn't it, where you just lined up your little figures, your army figures, and you went to war. I think it's a really healthy place to be in, where you can, you know, play a board game like that and enjoy it and enjoy the imagination and your own company. You know, it's quite childlike, and there's a lot to be praised about getting into that place, I think, as an adult. I don't know if you agree.
Yeah, I think if we look at my journey through solo gaming hobby, it's definitely an area of like personal growth as well, because one of the first games I sat down to play solo was Mansions of Madness, Fantasy Flight's Mansions of Madness in 2016. And I remember getting that out of the box. I bought that game specifically to play solo, and it was the first time I'd done something like this.
Yeah.
And I remember getting out of the box and I thought, what if someone knocks the door? What if someone knocks the door now and sees me playing a board game on my own? And I felt a little bit embarrassed.
Do you know what? It's really interesting you say that, because I had this question penciled down, but I wasn't sure if I was going to ask it, because I think by asking the question, it sounds judgmental, even though I don't want it to be. You know, because clearly board gaming is now a very mainstream activity. And, you know, dare I say, it's almost approaching socially acceptable. But do you think that there is a stigma attached to kind of soul board gaming? I think you did then, clearly from that example you gave me. But do you think there's still some kind of stigma attached to it? Would people be comfortable if they said, what's your hobby? To say, well, I like solo board games.
I think it's difficult to judge zeitgeist when I'm sort of in a bit of an echo chamber. You know, I've become a lot more comfortable with it. And, you know, the people that I speak to online are obviously very comfortable with it as well. However, I would generally say it has gotten better since 2016. I think the fact that so many people have dipped their toes in solo gaming, like, you know, pre and post pandemic. However, I do think there is still a bit of a stigma. I do still see comments online where people say, why would you ever play a board game solo? Why don't you just play a video game?
Yeah.
Which is obviously a false equivalence. You know, they're not the same thing.
No, they're not, are they?
And it's just people being a little ignorant, I want to say, you know, being a little bit judgmental. You know, a lot of people say, a common one I get quite a lot, Tom, is, well, I play board games to socialize. So if you're going to play solo, why don't you just play a video game?
Yeah.
It's as much a false equivalence as if I replied to that saying, why do you play board games for socializing? Why don't you just go to the pub?
It is a false equivalent. I mean, you know, we both accept, I suppose, that you do lose that social aspect. If you lose the social aspect, is there something that you gain from playing solo than if you had a group of people around you?
Yeah, there are lots of benefits to solo gaming that were kind of unexpected to me. And the more I spent time in the hobby, the easier they are to see. So a couple of the very obvious ones are things like, with losing a social aspect, there's also no downtime.
That's a really good point, that there's no downtime, actually. That's very important sometimes if you're playing a big, heavy Euro, that you feel like you're busy all the time.
Yeah, it can chop down like... So one of my favourite games is an old splotter game called Roads and Boats. This game is over 20 years old, and it's clunky, and when you play it sort of three-player, you're looking at a four-hour game. When I play it solo, I can play it in 45 minutes, so the time that you actually need to play the games is often greatly reduced. In addition to that, I see people who don't play solo online, and they'll say things like, I just got my copy of Sleeping Gods, but I don't think anyone's ever going to play it with me. The campaign's too long. I think I'll probably just have to sell it. And I always think, well, if you can't get a group to commit to it, you're obviously interested in that game. Why don't you just play it on your own? You're missing out.
Yeah.
You're missing out on and this goes back to your episode about playing versus collecting. If you're only going to play games when you've got that very special group of friends around who are going to be into that game, you're probably going to find that for the most part, you're going to be a bit more of a collector than a player. Playing since 2016, when I started playing solo games, I've definitely felt like much more of a player versus being a collector. You also gain the sort of flexibility. You know, when my partner says, I want to watch Corey and I'm not at all interested, I can say, that's all right, I'll go play a solo game. You know, I don't need to have friends around. It's kind of like the equivalent to your partner having a show on and you reading a book. You know, I see it as no different.
Yeah, and I see it as no different as well, clearly. So British listeners will be familiar with the concept of desert island discs as a Radio 4 thing, where somebody gets sent to a desert island and they're allowed to take some music with them. And I thought that was quite a nice little metaphor for solo board gaming, because obviously if you're on a desert island, you're going to be on your own. I was just interested, you know, for somebody that doesn't know too much about solo board gaming, what it is that you would bring with you, Mage Knight accepted, because I'll just say you can have that one for free.
I was wondering where you're going with that question then. It was off the back of me mentioning Corrie, and then you started with British listeners will be familiar, and I thought, Tom's not going to make me explain what Carnation Street is to people worldwide.
Oh, that's a good point, actually. We probably needed to go back a stage as well, didn't we, actually?
We don't need to touch on that.
No, let's call it Desert Island Dex. So, you know, what would you bring with you?
Brilliant. Okay, so, yeah, obviously Mage Knight would be top of the list, but you said I've got that one for free. So let's go a little bit left of field, and I'm going to pick a role-playing game instead, a game called Iron Swan. This game is designed to be played from the ground up without a games master. The resolution mechanic that you typically see in role-playing games will be to roll a dice or to roll several dice or a dice pool, and for a game master to interpret that roll. Iron Swan is built up with a system of moves that can be performed where the resolution mechanic, the game is good at prompting you as the player to come up with the resolution and move the story forwards.
Oh, that's quite interesting.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
So you actually have to come up with it yourself?
Yeah, so the game has a system where you answer some questions to help you world build. You come up with a character. It prompts you to think of an initial vow that you have to accomplish and a background vow for your overarching story. And then you start making moves towards your immediate vow, and the system will prompt you to come up with things that surprise you. Some of my most rich role-playing experiences have come from sitting down and playing this game on my own. I went through a stage of taking the Iron Swan books into the office at work and finding a quiet corner on my lunch break and just rolling some dice. And it was a lovely way to escape. And it goes back to the freedom that I was saying, like with multiplayer gaming. And I absolutely love multiplayer gaming. I hope I'm not coming across as an old curmudgeon who just likes sitting on my own. But I certainly couldn't.
No, not at all.
I certainly couldn't run a game of D&D on a lunch break. You know, it's just not possible. No. So yeah, Iron Swan. How many am I allowed on this desert island?
I reckon you can have another one. What's interesting to me, though, with the Iron Swan thing is, you know, when you've had a really vivid dream and then you wake up in the next morning and you want to tell everybody about the dream that you had and they're kind of like looking at you as if you're half mad. Do you ever have an experience in Iron Swan where you've experienced it all on your own and you kind of want to share what's happened to you? And it's quite hard to ever explain that to other people because clearly they weren't in that space with you. Do you ever have that kind of sadness about it being a solo experience and that it isn't something that everybody can say, oh, do you remember when this happened or that happened? Because clearly the narratives of that game are gripping for you and exciting, but it is just you there. And I wonder if you feel that matters to you or whether you're quite happy with that being something that you have only got yourself.
Yeah, Tom, you're hitting onto a really interesting part about solo gaming. Because, yeah, absolutely, that has happened to me. That has happened to me where I've wanted to tell people and they're just not interested because you're right, they weren't there. And the thing is, if we move away from board games and we talk about role-playing a little bit, when you're doing a traditional role-playing game, you're creating a shared memory, a memory that's shared with you and the other people that are there. So you're making something that feels real and permanent. And sometimes when you are sort of role-playing, yes, you do lose that element. One of the ways that I and a lot of solo role players combat this is by sort of making a journal of the adventures. So when we play, we sort of write it down, sometimes like a narrative, sometimes just as bullet points. You're creating something that's real that you can go back and look at, just like you can go back and talk to your friends about your adventures in D&D. It's not a shared experience, but you are still creating something that's real and isn't fleeting or disappearing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting. I mean, I've not played Iron Swan. I have played some Dungeons and Dragons in the past, but that was the bit that struck me really is the fact that you have these moments of narrative and just how you dealt with that on your own, really, not being able to talk about it. But that makes sense to me. Is there communities online where people share, you know, their solo experiences of playing games like this, or do people do tend to keep it quite private?
With Ironstorm specifically, there's actually a very active Discord server, Facebook group, and subreddit. The designer of that game, Sean Tompkin, is very good at creating supportive and engaged communities. And yes, a lot of people do share their journals. There's also a lot of actual play podcasts. I feel like for the size of these sort of small, independent, soloable role-playing games, the proportion of actual play podcasts per player compared to something more mainstream like your Dungeons & Dragons is actually pretty great. Now, I don't have any data to support that, but it feels like there are way more actual play sessions and podcasts and YouTube channels for those types of games than there should be based on the player size. And I think that comes from that desire to share it with people. And I guess if you don't play solo games, that probably feels like quite a lonely statement. But as someone who does play a lot, I know that being part of those communities is really fun and rewarding.
When you're playing that game, do you actually, obviously you wouldn't at work, but do you sometimes talk out loud to yourself when you're playing, or do you play the game in absolute silence, or do you kind of talk through as you're going?
That's really, really interesting. And earlier I mentioned about solo gaming as a chance for growth and becoming comfortable with yourself and moving past that stage of embarrassment. I think that's a line I haven't got past yet. When I play, I just play as sort of a journaling experience, as a writing experience. But there are games that I have played that you have to speak out loud. So for our show, we once covered a game called The Wretched. In The Wretched, you played as the lone survivor of a crew in a spaceship. And every day, once you go through your daily prompts that the game gives you, you then had to roleplay and log your daily logs through a microphone. So it encouraged you to actually record your daily logs physically in the real world.
Right.
So mechanisms like that help you get over that sort of embarrassment. But generally speaking, unless the game has specific rules and mechanisms that make me talk out loud, I will probably, when solo playing anyway, just treat it as a sort of meditative journaling experience rather than something that actually needs to be role played aloud.
Yeah, and when I played Dungeons and Dragons, it was interesting for me that I really enjoyed my experiences of playing Dungeons and Dragons, but the narrative was driven by three or four different players. And some of the players there were really interested in the fighting and were there to, you know, take down dragons. And for me, Dungeons and Dragons, the joy was the bits in between the fighting, the bits where you're in some kind of pub or talking to inhabitants of a village. The real narrative, I found the fighting actually quite dull in Dungeons and Dragons. And I suppose what's really nice about playing a game like that solo is that you can really channel that narrative in the way that you want it to be. Like, you don't have to do the bits that you're not that interested in.
And it goes to that freedom that I was mentioning earlier, when you don't... So moving away from role-playing games and going back into board games, when playing solo, yes, in a role-playing game, you can totally drive the narrative in ways that interests you without having to worry about other people. But going back to board games, you know, how many times have you had your game group over and you spend the first hour trying to decide what to play because, you know, Derek doesn't want to play Scythe today, but Johnny prefers to play Wingspan, and I don't know why all these games are Stonemaier, I think.
Yeah, but, you know, how many incoming, I think.
But it happens, right? And with solo, you don't have to, you don't really go through that when you just play what you want to play. And I think that's something really devilishly selfish about that, that just is nice. It's nice to do something that is just for you and not for anybody else. Because as adults, we spend a lot of time doing things for work and families and other people, you know?
Yeah, too right. I've just had an Easter holidays full of it, actually. So you've got Ironsworn with you. You've got Mage Knight. But you're also going to take one more game. And is there anything that you think that would complement those two?
Oh. So, yeah, we've got my crunchy sort of Euro-y decision-making adventure game. And we've got the narrative storytelling game. So I think what's missing here is something that's a little bit lighter, a little bit more modular, a little bit more pick up and play that doesn't require so much prior thought to get going. No characters to build, no heavy setup. So yeah, for me, a solo game like that would be my Marvel Champions collection.
I was going to say, Marvel Champions, I believe I've played it once. Is it similar to Arkham in terms of, it is quite similar, isn't it, as a game, but it's not as narrative driven. From what I remember, you're fighting against a villain. You've got a couple of villains up there, and all you're trying to do in each level is try to beat them, but there's no overarching narrative to the game. Is that fair?
Totally. And that's where the modularity comes in. What makes Marvel Champions very interesting is it has this kind of pick-up-and-play aspect that the other living card games from Fantasy Flight, like Lord of the Rings and Arkham Horror, don't have. Now, there's things that it loses from doing that, like the story element for sure. But when I play Marvel Champions, I can just pick up my box of villains, choose a villain, pick a hero, and have a totally unique experience based on the deck that I'm playing or the aspect that I'm choosing to play my hero in or the hero and villain combination or the difficulty that I'm choosing. There's a lot of modularity. You don't just choose a villain. You choose a sort of side, I'm trying to think of how I'd explain it without using jargony terms from the game, but you sort of pick a side plot that goes into the villain's deck as well. So you might be up against the Sinister Six, but also there might be like an alien invasion going on at the same time. And those sort of combinations, along with hero combinations, are endless. So it's almost like reading through a single issue of a comic book rather than a whole graphic novel, which Arkham Horror might be, for example.
Now that is a lovely analogy. I think that was spot on, actually, in terms of describing the differences. Have you ever tried Sentinels of the Multiverse as an alternative to Marvel Champions?
Yeah, very, very similar. Very similar. I don't know why Sentinels sort of left me a bit dry, but Marvel just really clicked for me. Perhaps I just need the recognition of the characters. And being a bit of a comic book nerd, it was kind of love at first sight. But yeah,
it had more resonance.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah,
more resonance for you.
Yeah, probably.
Right, well, I think we probably ought to need to be rounding up around here. So can I just finish by thanking you very much for coming on? It's been wonderful to talk to you about solo board gaming, and hopefully it's also been really good for other people to have a listen. I think I will give it another go. I know this sounds a little trite to be saying this at the end of a podcast talking to you. The game I'm looking at the minute on my shelf is Ark Nova, which I've played a few times multiplayer, and I believe has a solo mode in it as well. The reason I'm thinking I might try that one is because it's a game that I'm not yet that confident to teach people. So I think I'd quite like to get it on the table in a solo way, so that when people do come round, I can kind of reduce the hour-long rules explanation into something a little bit more elegant. So, yeah, thank you so much for coming on. It's been a real pleasure to have you on.
Yeah, no, well, thank you for having me on. It's been an absolute blast. I really appreciate your time. And if you do end up playing Ark Nova solo, I'd love to hear how it goes for you.
Yeah, and maybe one day, Norm, we can meet up in the real world and actually play a game together, despite all this talk about solo games. So it's
playing with other people.
Yeah, controversial, isn't it? You've kind of turned me off the idea now. Brilliant. Thank you for listening all.